Baseball cap and the sunglasses. All right, you know it's time to go. Wait, I got coffee. Forgot what she needs today, right here. Here we go. A Red Bull. It's a Red Bull kind of Thursday on Nancy Skinner Show. Alrighty, guys. Hi. It's me, Nancy Skinner. 1-888-64-NANCY. I'm just going to be honest with you, as I always am. I'm one of those honest hosts. Kind of my life's a reality TV show here. We have an excellent show coming up today, but I will tell you this. John's looking at me funny. You know, I'm tired, and there's a good reason for it. I wasn't out at same-sex orgy things last night. I was. We're coming up on the two-month anniversary of the new show, of the new Nancy Skinner Show, its newest incarnation. And so the team, we have a team of people working on this show, and they've been doing a great job. The website, there's all these changes coming to NancySkinnerLive.com, really great creative stuff, and podcasting, you know, everything we're working on, building the new studios. Well, it was incumbent upon me. We had to have our promo materials put together yesterday. We've always talented designers that have come up with great looking materials that kind of try to encompass what it is we're doing here on the show. But it was my job last night after the show to put together the demo reels for both my radio and television work. And after the show, I got home and did that. And I'm such a darn perfectionist. I know, but it's so tough to try and capture what this show is about because we do a little of everything. Finance, a little of culture wars. We talk about, you know, some fun stuff. We always try to have fun. We have both sides of the debate. I'm always engaging the other side. Grover Norquist was going to be here yesterday. His wife had a baby. So I'm like, bring him on. So anyways, that was my job last night, and I was sitting in front of my computer screen just hour after hour, 2, 3, 4 in the morning, just getting various clips and editing the audio and the TV stuff, all the Fox and CNN and all those shows that I've been doing recently and doing all that stuff. So it was a long night. I got a text in the middle of the night. Let me see. This is funny. I'm from Los Angeles. Before we jump right into this show, because I want to thank this person. This was pretty funny. I needed a laugh big time. When you're that tired and you just want to go to bed, but you know you got to you have to deliver because the team was needed those materials today. They had done all their work. It was my time to put up and do my job, which it's really hard for anyone but the host to really know how to get exactly what you want. So anyways, I get this email last night at 1:43 a.m. from Robert in L.A., and he says, Nancy, it was entitled Love You. Nancy, I normally hate pink, but it's perfect for you and your show. It sounds like you singing, delicious, sexy, and smart. Well, Robert, I'll tell you, and then he goes on to talk about AIG insuring over 80% of the non-military military contractors in Iraq, like KBR, Blackwater, Halliburton, and such. Interesting point that I will look into, Robert. But I'll tell you, that made me smile and got me through the rest of getting the job done, which we did. And here I am. So, but luckily, we knew that we had a lot going on today. And so I feel good. Got my Red Bull coffee, got a little rest. So here I am. That's the deal. You can live life with me. Now, the gay marriage thing. I told you there is a quickening. There is a speeding up of time as it regards gay marriage. We've been talking about it on the show over this past week with the decisions by both the Iowa Supreme Court and the Vermont legislature. Actually, there was an overturning a veto by the governor in Vermont yesterday. And so you have four states now legally allowing gay marriage. This today in the New York Times, New York, everyone's trying to catch up, play a little catch up here. So advocates in New York and New Jersey say the actions in Vermont and Iowa are a reminder now that now more than ever it's time for the states to grant full marital rights for gay and lesbian couples. And so the governor of New York, David Patterson, vowed to introduce a bill that would legalize gay marriage. He told an Ithaca radio station he was inclined to push the bill forward, even if it was unclear that the measure had enough votes to pass. He said, we'll put a bill out and let the people decide one way or another. Why can't people just debate the bills, vote on it, and it goes up or down? So the National Organization for Marriage, I mentioned them the other day. This is a group probably, I'm trying to figure out where their funding comes from, frankly, at this juncture when everybody is broke. Who is giving money to a group to run $1.5 million advertising, national advertising campaign? And to do that, I'm wondering that. But here's their ad that starts airing across the nation today.
There's a storm gathering.
The clouds are dark and the winds are strong.
And I am afraid.
Some who advocate for same-sex marriage have taken the issue far beyond same-sex couples.
They want to bring the issue into my life.
My freedom will be taken away.
I'm a California doctor who must choose between my faith and my job.
I'm part of a New Jersey church group punished by the government because we can't support same-sex marriage.
I'm a Massachusetts parent, helplessly watching public schools teach my son that gay marriage is okay.
But some who advocate for same-sex marriage have not been content with same-sex couples living as they wish.
Those advocates want to change the way I live.
I will have no choice.
The storm is coming.
But we have hope. A rainbow coalition of people of every creed and color are coming together in love to protect marriage. Visit nationformarriage.org. Join us.
Paid for by National Organization for Marriage, which is responsible for the contents of this ad.
Okay, I guess in going to their website, they want you to donate to this ad. That's how they're paying for it. I'm sure there's some big heavy hitter funders on there. I just don't know what the economic interest is in those funders. I get a lot of the other lobbying connections. This one I'm not sure, but they want you to pony up to continue to put these ads on the air. In these economic times, I think they're going to have a hard time because if it's like, I got to pay for my kids, you know, new gym shoes or fight marriage in another state. Not going to do it. All right, so what we're going to do is we're going to talk to a couple of very interesting people who have views on this. The Reverend Eric Lee of the Southern Christian Law Center has been very out in front in L.A. and Los Angeles on this issue given his opposition to Proposition 8. And he has been one of L.A.'s most vocal and visible civil and human rights activists on this issue. And we had the opposing view yesterday, you will remember. We had the Bishop Harry Jackson Jr., who was an African-American minister who opposed gay marriage. So I want to make sure that we're getting all viewpoints mixed in here. And then I got an email from Melanie Henderson. She's a listener. And she wrote me her own personal story. And I said, you know what? You need to share that, Melanie, with the folks, the listenership, because it struck me and it's very interesting. So we're gonna first of all say hi, Reverend Lee and Melanie Henderson. I believe you were both on the show at the same time.
Yes.
Hi.
Say hi to each other.
Hi, how are you?
Hello.
I'm glad you could join me. I wanted both of you to be on to talk about this National Organization of Marriage effort and the opposition and what I also consider the tipping point. Here that it seems to be that there's a quickening, there's a forward movement in
yes.
this perhaps because of Iowa being the heartland of the mainland. So if you will hold, I'm up against a break. I was long. I had to explain why I had to pull an all-nighter. I felt like I was in college doing a term paper. But you know what? I'm a rallier and I got a Red Bull and a coffee and I love talking to you. So if you will hold on, we will get right into this issue. Okay? Great. All right. We'll do that. Put them both on hold. And, we will get your calls in. 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the program. Now it's New York, okay? It was Iowa, Vermont, New York. I think you're going to start to see it just whoosh, a watershed here to get this issue out of the way is what I think is going to happen. A lot of people, some people took stands, and that allows other people to take stands who were unwilling to. And if we could only apply that same sort of guts on so many issues, we wouldn't have as many problems. That's it. All right, 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the Nancy Skinner Show.
Sometimes I don't know why.
Saying that and getting their way with the advancement of laws allowing the same-sex couples to marry. This is the Nancy Skinner Show. I'm Nancy Skinner, 1-888-64-NANCY. Okay, so here's the deal. Yesterday we had on Bishop Jackson, Harold, what's his name? Jim Jackson. And he was, he's a nice guy. He's an African-American pastor, however, who is, he's conservative in nature. He's been on the show before. He opposed gay marriage. And I tried to get him to talk about, isn't this the same as interracial rulings of the past? Aren't you just sort of going through the same thing with a different, what is it, fear or ignorance about someone who is different? And he firmly held his ground that no, it was completely different. Interracial marriage is different than gay marriage. So Reverend Eric Lee is president and CEO of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of the greater LA area. That Dr. King's organization and one of LA's most vocal and visible civil and human rights activists. He is also African American and has been getting people to address the issue of homophobia. So he joins us. First of all, Reverend Lee, thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Glad
and I'm
to be on the show.
Great. And I'm going to read a story, just the email from Melanie, too, and then we'll jump into this. So Melanie wrote me from Los Angeles. You're in L.A., too, right, Melanie?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So she wrote, "Hi, Nancy. I was listening to your show today. There's a section of the show that's right on now, and I knew I would only be able to listen sparingly because the opposing point of view was so outrageous." Here's why Melanie says that. My mother, Steffi, was white and Jewish, and my father, Luther, was black. My mother died when I was 9, and my father died in 2003. So I was born in 1957, and my mother died June 3rd, 1967. Yes, just days before the Supreme Court overturned the laws against interracial marriages. So my mother did not live to see that. I experienced the prejudice against my family and saw how hard my mother worked to make sure I had a safe environment to grow up in. And Melanie turns out, she says, I am bisexual, so I'm a biracial, bisexual, black, white, Romanian Jew, and I'm here to tell you that the interracial marriage prejudice is exactly the same as the gay marriage prejudice. First of all, Melanie, thanks for sharing that story and for joining us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for putting it out there, because, you know, this occurs to me every day when I hear this stuff going on, that it's really very simple. And it gets made more complicated by the justifications that people give for their fears. So what I try to do when I'm talking to people about it is make it very personal, because it is. It impacts each person who is being denied their rights and their children and their families. I think that there are a lot of people who oppose gay marriage who, if they realized how much suffering they were causing by standing in the way of something that's a simple, basic, equal right, they might stop doing it. A lot of them might, you know, say, let me rethink this.
Reverend Lee, is Melanie a perfect test case for you, or a poster child, her mother having not lived to see the day of interracial marriage and she herself being gay? I want you to answer that question, but two, also to address the bishop's comments yesterday that they're completely two different things.
Well, I think that Melanie is an excellent poster child for this, and primarily because racism, discrimination, prejudice, if it's allowed to exist in any form, we will never rid our country and humanity of this vicious type of insult upon people because they're different. And so to that degree, and Dr. King said it very appropriately, that injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And so we have to rid ourselves, our communities, of any type of discrimination.
But I got to tell you this, and we're just up against our break here, so we can answer it on the other side. There is a significant feeling among African Americans against gay marriage, and it's striking to me that those numbers are as high as they are. And I want you to address why that is. It would seem that if anybody understood the legacy of discrimination, it would be African Americans and could relate, but it doesn't translate that way
right
into the polls. So hold on, and both of you guys, I'm sure, have thoughts on that. Hold on to the show,
yeah,
and your thoughts too. 1-888-64-NANCY is the number to the program on the Nancy Skinner Show. On the cover on the Nancy Skinner Show, 1-888-64-NANCY. My guests are the Reverend Eric Lee of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of Greater Los Angeles, and Melanie Henderson, whose mother died just days or a few days before the Supreme Court overturned the ban on interracial marriage, and didn't live to see that day. So, Reverend Lee, let me start with you.
Yes.
I've been looking at various polls, and I know overall the trend is that people are starting to be more supportive of equal rights for marriage. The long trend is that. But there's also some conflicting poll numbers as it relates to the breakout. Clearly, evangelical Christians have, you know, Proposition 8 was like 88% opposed, they supported it, which means they opposed gay marriage. The numbers on race were kind of mixed. They weren't nearly the numbers of younger and whiter voters. Why is that, first of all?
Well, I, particularly for African Americans, a couple things happened. One, Prop 8 was allowed to be framed and defined as a religious issue, primarily by the Mormon Church and the right-wing evangelicals. And once that occurred, then it was very difficult to pose a counter argument for the general population on why marriage equality is a civil right, because it was the dialogue occurred primarily within the religious context.
It was a framing issue.
Yeah, it was a framing issue, and what happened? Those against Prop 8 attempted to make the battle for gay and lesbian rights synonymous to the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s that was led primarily by African Americans and impacted African Americans the most. But African Americans did not accept that argument primarily because of the belief that being gay or lesbian is a matter of choice rather than a matter of birth. And discrimination that occurs against African American is based on the birthright of blackness or being, you know, just simply because you're African American. And so it was, I think that was strategically, a bad move.
They knew that they were splitting the African American community by framing it that way.
Yeah, if it were framed as a human rights issue, if it were framed as a, even you can go as far as saying a civil rights issue, because I fundamentally believe marriage is a civil institution. The state issues the license. Clergy, when they, before the performance ceremony, will say, by the powers vested in me and by the state of California, I now pronounce you. And so it is.
Oh, yeah, you're taking, you're signing documents to go in courts.
That's right.
On the hook for a long time.
And so, but because it was framed in originally in a religious context, and I think the thing that was most disturbing to me, the Mormon Church's role in this, particularly with their history of discrimination against the African American community, was most disturbing to me because, you know,
They used
strategies and tactics to oppress another group of people that they used to oppress African Americans. And, you know, because of the framing of the issue and those against Prop 8 did not come back with a strong enough case on making this a civil issue, that's where we lost, I think, in the African American community. The understanding about the civil impact of the vote for Prop 8.
That's why you needed Melanie Henderson to get out there and say, you know, her mother died just before the ban on interracial, and this is a civil rights issue.
That's what I do with people. I mean, I try to cut through everything, because by the time we argue about God or argue about, you know, suffering or argue about whether it's a choice or being born with it, which, you know, you are born the way you are, but by the time we convince everybody of that, it's, you know, years from now. The way I cut through that is, you know, my mother died when I was 9. I start there because then they're paying attention. Because before that, all the fears and all the ads by the Mormon Church for Prop 8 were nothing but lies.
Wait, there was a lot of misinformation.
Tell me a little bit about it. Obviously, I'm in Detroit, and I didn't get to hear those ads. What were the nature of them?
Go ahead, Melanie.
Reverend, you probably have more of the details.
Well, let me just say from the clergy's perspective, one of the strongest pieces of misinformation was that if Proposition 8 was defeated and marriage equality was given to all people, then if a gay or lesbian couple came to a church and wanted a church or a pastor to perform the ceremony and they said no because it contradicted their belief system, that they could be sued and they could possibly lose their 501c3 status. Now, how they tried to justify that was in Massachusetts, where a Catholic charity who engaged in adoptions was told that because you receive state money, you cannot refuse gay parents, gay or lesbian parents, from adopting a child, and so they would rather close their doors than to break what they believe was their belief system. And so that was one of the.
That sounds like a fear tactic, though, because you know, clearly the separation of church and state. We talked about this yesterday. You cannot tell a church, you know, how to practice their religious beliefs.
Right.
But even the threat, you know, people are so easy. They'll believe anything. That's why advertising works and politics, politicians get elected. But, you know, just the fear that, oh, we're going to take away your church, your 501c3,
right,
because we can sue you and force you into it. Even that suggestion of that fear-based thinking, is that what you're saying? That had enough power?
And they were saying that it's going to have to be taught in the schools, and how are you going to protect your children from this? So essentially, they steered it away from what was actually going on, which was simply granting the same rights to this group of people that everyone else has, and steering it on to the people who want to oppress them, and saying you're the victim, not the people who are trying to get their rights. So they confused the issue.
Well, I know, you know, there's a case to be made, Melanie, that we should teach marriage in school.
Well, that's, I mean, yes. Let's we should start with one thing and then work up to that, I think.
Well, not even as it relates to the sexes, but just the basics of how you're going to survive a very difficult, you know, long-term relationship by communication and all those things aren't bad things, but...
Here's what I think that they should have done, and should this come up in another state, I actually got an email about Iowa because already people want to prepare for the possibility of a Prop 8 sort of thing happening there.
Yeah.
But what I really feel that they should do is make it personal. Everything should be, I think, or at least partly, about here are couples. You know, this is their life. And this is what you are denying them being able to do. You know, they won't be able to go into the hospital to see their loved one if they're dying, for example. You know, people don't think about that stuff very often when they're, you know, in their fears.
Reverend Lee, do you think that sort of framing is what you need to do next time?
I think what has happened is that that in part of the framing, they're looking at almost exclusively at the sexual relationship,
mm-hmm,
as opposed to looking at the legality of marriage. And really,
that'll go bad just like in any relationship.
Right, I mean, you know, emotionally you look at, you know, a lifelong companion, someone who you have shared goals with. It's not, anybody who's married could tell you it's not about sex, believe me. After you get married again, you're married for a few years.
Right.
That is, you know, that is not the priority in the relationship. And so.
It's an important part of it.
It's a part of it.
Right.
But I think that people have focused on that part in playing to their religious fears or the religious prescriptions about humanity. And so, as long as this debate is framed within a religious context, it's going to be very difficult to convince people that this is a civil issue, and that any time you deny one group of people the same rights that another group enjoys, then fundamentally it's a denial of civil rights, and it needs to be taken out of that religious context.
And I do think that, that the more that people can be reminded that these are simply human beings. You know, we're all human beings. I find it amazing that people forget that, but they seem to forget that. It's very simple.
Yeah.
We're all human beings and should have the same rights.
You know, marriage did not originate in the church. It just, you know, it was about relationships that were consummated for various purposes. But marriage, you know, was taken over by the Catholic Church when it was exerting its prowess over states and governments. And so at one point, the Catholic Church was the only entity that recognized legal marriages. And so, you know, if you go look at the history and the origin, the nation of marriage, it didn't start in the church. It did not start as a religious institution. What happens is you have now the religious community, the church community, forcibly imposing its theology upon a state institution.
Right.
And that's wrong.
All right, so now you know you're going to have the blowback. Now you have this national Nation for Marriage launching these national ads. They're going to try.
What a cheesy ad, may I say, though.
What's that?
That was such a cheesy ad.
Well.
The music wasn't very good.
I know.
You know, it just was.
Here's the problem. I mean, they don't have much of a case, and I think it's a dwindling case. But nonetheless,
yes.
I want to ask both of you, and here's my, I have to, we have to run along the show, but here's my question. It's been a mismatch of sort of determinations by courts and legislatures now. How does this move forward? It looks like the federal government, nobody wanted to touch that. They had the DOMA thing. I'm going to ask you, each of you, how do you see this issue? Do you think that our tipping point has been reached, one, and how do you see it moving forward in this whole mismatched way, or that the states are just going to use this opportunity to just get it over with and move on to other issues? First Reverend Lee, and make sure you give your website out.
Okay. Well, I believe Melanie was right when she said you have to make it personable. I think you have to take this to the streets, to the grassroots people, and have roundtable discussions humanizing gay and lesbian people, because that's exactly, you know, it did not happen during these campaigns. And finding out the personal stories about individuals, their characters, their commitments to social justice, or commitment to anything that improves people's quality of life, irrespective of sexual orientation. And once you you know, it was almost like when African Americans were in the civil rights movement, they say, once you get to know me, that I want the same things you want. You know, I bleed the same way you bleed. I hurt the same way you hurt. But I think that type of relationship has to be established with the gay and lesbian community, and do some intersecting with other communities to be able to personalize it and make it a more human event than mm-hmm. just a sexual event.
Like Rick Warren's. He said it's very, very low on his priority list now, you know, in the aftermath of the inauguration. So maybe you need to reach out to evangelical
Christians.
Well,
we did. You know, I was working with Rick Jacobs from the Courage Campaign, and there was a challenge for Rick Warren to debate me on this issue. And, you know, and they finally responded that it's not a priority for them anymore. Evidently, it was a priority at one time when he made some very negative and hurtful statements about a segment of our society. But
that's called progress, Reverend. Yeah. If it goes from being on the top five non-negotiable issues to very low on my priority list, you're getting somewhere,
well,
Reverend.
Well, I think he realized, you know, the error in assigning very negative and derogatory labels to gay and lesbian, our gay and lesbian brothers and sisters. And so, you know, hopefully God is dealing with his heart on that.
All right, Melanie, how do you see this? Other states, maybe Iowa, you said first, might go the constitutional ban route. Or do you think that changing hearts and minds will be a legislative thing that, you know, because that's tougher, man. We can't even get the legislature in California to save the budget from a $42 billion bankruptcy. You think you're going to get those guys on gay rights?
I think there's a couple of things here. I mean, there's California. The fact that Prop 8 passed in California was almost, I'm not going to say it was a good thing because obviously it was a terrible thing, but it lit a fire under everyone because California is, you know, Hollywood, so people think. So it made people stop and go, wait a second, you know, this is important, and people took to the streets.
Everywhere. I saw signs in western Michigan, which is really rural, people standing there with Prop 8 signs and going, wow.
So I think it's a tipping point. It's an opportunity for a tipping point if everyone is organized, and I believe that is what is starting to coalesce, is a national organization, a national movement, you know, to get this done. But if it happens as a patchwork and that helps the move, that's fine.
You'll take whatever way
it's going to work in whatever state.
Great.
And that helps the whole thing to rise.
Well, listen, what I'm going to do is keep you on the air, and you two, we're going to hook you up. John's going to make sure you two have each other's phone numbers. Is that okay?
Can I give my website?
Please. Yeah.
If you just go to sclclosangeles.org, sclclosangeles.org, it'll take you into our website.
That's fantastic, and you two need to meet.
Okay.
Because it is about personalizing it, and your story, Melanie, it's sad. It's so sad to lose a mother, but to lose your mother and have lived that whole life of having that issue.
She would love for it to be helpful to people, though.
You know,
I know that.
She sees. She knows. Somewhere, I believe that you're out there doing good things. All right. Well, thank you both. I really do appreciate Reverend Lee, you being here, and Melanie Henderson. And good luck to you. And keep me posted.
Thank you, Nancy.
Okay,
you
bet. Hang on. We'll get you connected. All right. 1-888-64 Nancy, the number of the program. If you've been hanging on, Sylvia, I know has some thoughts on. We had a lot of comments on Bishop Jackson yesterday, so we'll let you get it. Your last thoughts on this and the National Organization for Marriage ads. Are they gonna rile the base? I don't know. I just don't think they're. All right, your calls are next on the Nancy Skinner Show.
I'm Portia de Rossi. When I got married, all I was thinking about was my own joy at committing to love my partner for the rest of my life. I didn't think about all the people I was hurting by getting married. That was selfish. So, I want to apologize to all those people whose lives have been affected by me getting married. To Elaine Suttler, who suffered painful and debilitating paper cuts from holding up her simple message of intolerance. To Amanda Milch, who came down with pneumonia while protesting my marriage in the rain. To George Binder, whose mind was so tragically blown by the idea of gays getting married, he has to spend the rest of his life wearing this hat. To Buddy the dog, who was forced to wear this ridiculous sign even though he himself is gay. Thanks to Proposition 8, good people and animals like these will never again be subjected to the horrors of gay people getting married. But for me, it's too late. I know there is no way I can make up for the pain I have caused. All I can say is, I'm sorry.
Paid for by married gay people who are sorry. And the National Coalition of Bonobo Chicks.
Oh, my goodness. That's Portia de Rossi, Ellen's wife, Ellen DeGeneres' wife. That little spoof aired on the Jimmy Kimmel Show the other night. Pretty funny stuff. At 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the program. Sylvia has been holding on. Thank you for your patience, Sylvia.
Yes, hi. I know Harry Jackson. I've been to his church. I've eaten with him. I have his cell phone number. I've debated him twice on the radio. Number one, he's not that bright.
That's not right,
because when I debated him, he said, oh, that's too deep for me. He admitted it. He said, that's too deep for me, twice. He told us that he wanted us to get to know him. We got to know him, and what we found was the man is dishonest and vicious. The last conversation I had with him, I talked to him about how he had distorted everything we had said, because he'll glad hand you, and then there's a Jekyll and Hyde personality. I know him. I have a cell phone number. I've been
Thing. Where I think you're going to be most powerful is not in personal attacks on him, but on what he's saying. I've always found that to be, and that's how I operate. Just instead of saying you think, you know, calling names, it doesn't work when the other side does it. It doesn't work really when you do it because you haven't said, all right, what is it?
I'm not bearing false witness. He bears false witness.
Well,
I'm telling the truth about who he is, but I felt I didn't miss him yesterday because I know his talking points.
I know, but here's my suggestion to you, Sylvia, is that, you know, come on and say, look, this is where he's wrong. He kept saying there was nothing connecting racial equality, that gay marriage is a civil rights. Go to that and say, you know, if you want to talk about hypocrisy, that's fair game, always fair game. But just to call someone names, Sylvia, I got to tell you, I just don't believe in that philosophy. That's just, it's not effective, and it doesn't get anywhere, and so that's just my view on it. All right, coming up, I'm going to speak to a very conservative Republican congressman about the budget and the GOP alternative. This should be fun. 1-888-64-NANCY. I want to get right into this, folks, because we've got, I know we've been focusing on a whole host of issues. Let's get back to the budget, shall we? Because that still has not passed yet. A lot of maneuvering going on in Congress with what to do about the president's the budget proposal in Congress. Everyone's has their position. Now, the GOP recently introduced an alternative budget to the congressional once that went through the House and the Senate. And so there's going to be a lot of wrangling, hand-wringing going on about that. The GOP budget was, I have to say, widely panned at first for having no numbers. And then when it did have numbers, the criticism was, well, you know, this is kind of what you've been doing for 8 years. So joining me to talk about the GOP alternative budget, the need for stimulus or not, and stimulus of all kinds, I suppose, defense spending as well, is Congressman Greg Harper. He is the Republican congressman from Mississippi's 3rd Congressional District. He's also on the Budget Committee and can discuss issues relating to the budget as well as North Korea. He's very versed in those issues. And I thank you, Congressman, for joining me, first of all.
Well, thank you. It's amazing. What was I thinking letting them put me on the Budget Committee? I mean, I must have lost my mind somewhere in that process.
Well, I think you had to pull that shit, didn't you? When you got elected, didn't they give you that list of committees and say, check one of these?
Well, see, I made a mistake probably of, I guess I was the freshman class representative on the steering committee, so I worked on making sure everybody else got their committee assignments, and then, so here I am, you know?
Especially during a global economic meltdown. So your timing is also off, Congressman.
I'm telling you, it's amazing, you know, and I can tell you 3 months ago I was a lot smarter than I am now.
Well, it could have been worse. You could have been on the House Banking Committee.
You're right. I'm thankful for being on the Budget Committee, as you said. You're right.
All right, well, let's jump into that a little bit. Obviously, we're in trying times with the economy falling off a cliff, as Warren Buffett has said, and we all know that. The president is firmly supportive of a stimulus package, and I know there were no Republican votes on that. I'm sure you didn't support that. You know, what is your opposition to the president's budget, and why? Let's start with a simple question. And why do you think that the GOP alternative really is anything different than what has been presented, which is, you know, I played the sound from the congressman who presented that. It's essentially a freeze on discretionary spending, lowering corporate income taxes, kind of the same thing that we've been doing for 8 years that, in my view, got us to this. Why do you think this alternative budget really deserves even the attention of the media right now?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of discussion on what the best approach is and trying, you know, really all we want to do is know what the real conditions are. And, you know, Nancy, I will say one of the greatest things right now is having served for all of 3 months and a couple of days is I'm not getting blamed for anything yet. So that's, you know, that's a good thing for us too. But, you know, and we hear the discussion that, this is, you know, been a continuation of 8 years of the same policies or whatever, you know, the argument may be. And, you know, I do want to try to look at things unemotionally and I just want to know what the facts are and then let us make the best decisions we can, even if some of those decisions are hard. But, you know, in fairness, while those have been the policies of the Bush administration for 8 years, the Democrats have been in control of the House and Congress for since they won the elections in 06. So, you know, there have been opportunities in there that they've had the last, couple of years that I think, show that nothing really changed during that time that we could see by, as an observer, not as an elected official.
Well, because we didn't have you had the veto pen. But so you're a freshman congressman.
That's right.
I didn't realize that. So that's really an interesting perspective to have, Congressman, because you're really walking into it right now, being in the opposition party. Some polls I saw yesterday had the Republican Party ranked at something the lowest in 25 years, whatever the number was. And so, obviously you got elected as a Republican. If I were to take off my hat and be a neutral observer, it would seem to me that a smart Republican would spend some time looking around and looking for opportunities to score some bipartisan accomplishments and,
sure,
you know, lay low a little bit. Let these guys have their way, and then come election time, you know, say what your pronouncement was on it, as opposed to just, you know, that they're getting tapped with the party of no, and that's further reducing the, I think, the numbers, because people don't want no right now. People are hurt. I live in Detroit, Congressman, so, you know, you can understand. Well, I don't know if you can understand. It's 12% unemployment.
Yeah,
people are angry, and they want some action, and no just doesn't seem like a really good answer.
Well, and certainly when you talked about the polling and the approval ratings, you know, here I am. I went from practicing law for 27 years, and then I changed my profession to Congress, and I still drop in my approval rating. Now, that is,
yeah,
you know, hard to do when you take that approach. But, you know, there are certainly, I think the country wants some bipartisan approaches to certain things. But let's face it, they don't require any Republican votes to pass legislation. The numbers, that's just the way that it is.
Mm-hmm.
So,
are you talking about budget reconciliation?
Well, I'm certainly saying on any piece of legislation that they have.
But what's being reported is that the leadership is enforcing in the Senate the filibuster so that they do have to have 60 votes over at your the other house, and we don't have those.
Well, and you know, those numbers are very delicate, and it doesn't take a lot of work in a lot of cases to not have 40 votes. So those certainly gives a little leverage to the Senate on what's going to be in the final bill. But at this point, you know, what I've seen is, and I voted against the stimulus bill, and I obviously, you know, there were no Republican votes for the stimulus mm-hmm. bill in the House or for the president's budget.
Oh yeah, I noticed that.
And that was, and there, you know, there were a variety of reasons why I could not support either of those. But you know, when the economy is struggling, and you know, when nationally it's 8.5%, in places like where you are, it's been much worse. And many parts of the country have been double-digit unemployment. And so those problems are a great concern. How do you help the economy? Well, to me, you've got to pay for this legislation somehow. So who's going to pay for it? It appears to be those individuals that make, as a household, more than $250,000 a year are going to see a tax increase, and a lot of that burden will be on them. But it looks to me, from what we've seen, that, 64% of those are small business owners. And, you know, when I had jobs in high school and college, they were small business owners that hired me. And, you know, to put the burden of that on them, I don't think is the right approach to take.
But it's only on people who make over $250,000, whether they are small business owners. I don't know that figure is correct. I'll assume, Congressman, you have better researchers than I do. So, but they're still making over $250,000, and that's a tiny segment of the population in general. Whatever you call them, it's not the most people are about 40. The median is about $42,000.
But it's those, you know, and like you said on the statistics too, Nancy, as you know, 69% of all statistics are made up on the spot. Or was that 62%? Anyway, it's, you know, we do have those issues as you look at the numbers. But we should be looking at ways, you know, most of the jobs that are created in this country have been done by small businesses. And, you know, I'd rather have a community that had 10 small businesses that employed 10 each than one that hired 100 that might wind up being shut down. And so the small business growth is important, I think, as we try to recover. And you know, the economy, while it's certainly bad and very bad in certain segments of the economy, how do you address those issues to make that recovery? Well, you know, is the bailout approach, you know, to me, that approach hasn't really worked well yet. And so, how do you do it? Well, I think you do it by helping the small businesses and creating that, and you don't spend money that you don't have. And so concentrating on those segments of the economy, the finance and the banking, those areas to make sure they're stable are certainly very important. But the stimulus bill, for instance, created 33 new federal government programs. Well, at a time where you're trying to get a grip on the economy, I don't understand how new government programs stimulate the economy or how that's good to grow if your growth of jobs should be coming from the private sector. So, look, I'm learning. I want to do what's right for the country.
Here's what I'll give you a real specific example we can dive into because when you talk about that, because it's something that affects your district, I know, and that is the decision to cut back on some weapon systems, including the Air Force's F-22, is in your home district. So, if you will hang with me, we'll get to that because there's going to be a big debate about that one. I know that's the mother of all debates. You're going and you'll be in the middle of that. So, I would like to get your thoughts on that whole situation. Congressman, right? Congressman Greg.
That's it.
All right, we will be back. Let's see. Here you are, Greg. I'm losing my thing. What? Greg Harper. Okay, I was going to call
Thank you Nancy.
Some other name, but we'll get used to you. You're new. We like having you.
My mother still calls me by the dog's name, so don't worry about it.
We won't call you that. All right, but we'll take some calls. 1-888-64 Nancy on the other side of this. We're talking about military cutbacks because, let's see, the F-22, Lockheed Martin, that is in the congressman's district or at least a portion of it. And that's kind of a stimulus bill of sorts that's going to be debated soon in Congress. All right, more to come on the Nancy Skinner Show.
Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Are you ready?
Yeah.
Are you ready for that?
I guess so.
Come on, man.
Say go.
Take me down where the love on your phone. Kiss you night. Feel what you
All right, the big budget battles will continue on the bigger budget, but there is a stealth budget battle going on behind the scenes concerning the acquisition of military weapons and systems, and those are big numbers too. So remember the first stimulus bill was $700 billion? That is likely to be the Pentagon's budget, $700 billion, and that is a lot of stimulus going to a lot of states to build weapon systems. Joining me to talk about that is Congressman Greg Harper. He is in the 3rd District of Mississippi, and Lockheed Martin has a strong presence in Mississippi where they make the F-22, one of the weapon systems that Secretary Gates said would no longer be continued. Congressman, you know, my senator and friend is Carl Levin here for many, many years, and chairman of the Armed Services Committee. And they came out and just said, look, all right, F-22, these things end up costing $350 million per plane. They were designed to penetrate airspace of the Soviet Union to counter large formations of enemy bombers in Cold War scenarios that today are just inconceivable, and to achieve air superiority high over Eastern Europe, which is basically broken down in an economic catastrophe. So this system, the overruns, the fact that we no longer fight that sort of conventional warfare, that we're looking at irregular, Al-Qaeda's not, we can't get them in Tora Bora with F-22s. It costs $350 million. And they wanted something like 750 of these things originally. They've said, what, four more? And then we just can't, we don't need it and we can't afford it. Are you saying that you obviously support the continuation of the F-22?
I do support the continuation of it because so many of our weapon systems are so old. And once you delay procurement of a new weapon system, you know, it takes forever to get something else on the drawing board. And certainly, you know, I have let's be honest, I have a vested interest, obviously, in the continuation of the F-22 to help jobs in our district. It does have a benefit with the Lockheed Martin facility over in the eastern part of my district. And actually, we toured that facility, Nancy, this past Tuesday, and a great facility. They do a lot of the C-130s. And they do a smaller portion on the F-22, the stabilizers, and they have about a year and a half. If they hold at the number, I believe it was 187, if I'm not mistaken, if they hold at that number, then they have about another year and a half of work at that plant. So,
but Congressman, isn't that stimulus? Yeah. Isn't that the same stimulus you're opposed to, you know, for other areas, shovel-ready projects? This is spending money on something that the military themselves deem useless. And so if you're spending useless money to create jobs, is that, sir, not the definition of stimulus that you opposed?
And obviously there's always some arguments that you could make along either lines of those in some areas. But the reason I voted against the stimulus bill was because it was posted online at midnight the night before we voted. If there had been a Republican president and a Republican speaker, I still would have voted against it, because I'm not going to vote on something of that magnitude without at least a few days to break it down with my staff and study it.
You know, I'm plumb out of time. Congressman Greg Harper, it really was a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you so much.
Come back anytime, and good luck learning the ropes.
Okay,
great, and come back and join us. We appreciate that. All right, 1-888-64-NANCY, the number to the Nancy Schedule. It is Nancy Skinner and the Nancy Skinner Show. 1-888-64-NANCY. Just reviewing my conversation with Congressman Greg Harper of Mississippi's 3rd District. Very nice gentleman. Everyone always harps on me because I have both points of view. I have Republicans on, Democrats on. I'm very nice to him. My producer's looking at me funny. Gosh, you're so nice to this guy. You know, I didn't really challenge him on his opposition to the stimulus plan. That he had it, the GOP alternative. I didn't turn the knife or the screws on him on that. Came back from the break and we talked about the military budget and the F-22 Raptor, which is Lockheed Martin and based in his district, which has been given the axe. And these are planes designed for a useless purpose, the Soviet Union air combat. And he said, well, it's about the jobs. Isn't that just what you said? You oppose stimulus? This is a useless program. This is make work, make plane programs, according to our Senator Levin and Secretary Gates and others. And I have to say, the congressman seemed just a little uncomfortable at that point. So there is a method to my madness. I can be very nice and call people out on their little, shall we say, conflicts of facts before them. So, listen, there's another guy out there. Governor Mark Sanford now is fighting back. Ben Smith is one of my favorite bloggers at Politico and was opining today on the Mark Sanford fighting back routine. He's taken a lot of heat locally for refusing stimulus funds. So he took to the airwaves in this ad saying why he's fighting back.
Governor Mark Sanford.
Recent days have been difficult in our state and in our country. Many families are struggling with challenges we've not seen in our lifetimes. Some say the solution lies in more government spending and deeper debt. The truth is, more tax dollars will be spent in our state this year than ever before. But there must be a stopping point. Going further into debt will not solve a problem that was created by too much debt. There must be a price that we will not impose on future generations. For me, the easy thing would be to accept money handed out from Washington. But the easy thing isn't always the right thing. We've proposed a budget that responsibly addresses our state's critical needs without more debt. To get there, we have to finally restructure the broken ways our government operates. There is a better way than saddling our children with massive debts. That's what I'll continue to fight for.
There you go, Governor Mark Sanford.
Paid for by Carolinians for Reform.
Who is that? Isn't that interesting, Governor Mark Sanford? Ben Smith joins us now to talk about this. Ben, thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Excuse me, I'm all choked up. Was that ad the tone of that ad was, that's very Madison Avenue. I'm trying to discern, and maybe I know you have better reporting. Was that a response to heat, or was that about attracting light and using his refusal to take stimulus dollars?
Well, there's a kind of, mutually beneficial thing going on between the White House and Mark Sanford, who nobody had ever heard of outside South Carolina until the White House started attacking him, or the Democratic National Committee started attacking him, because I think they wanted, a white Southern governor to be kind of a poster child for, as opposed to, say, Bobby Jindal or Sarah Palin, to be the poster child for the kind of, dead-enders who were refusing the stimulus. So they attacked him. They aired an ad in South Carolina, actually, attacking him. And this, in theory, was a response to that. I mean, I think it was playing as much to the national conservative movement as it was to people in South Carolina, though he is taking a lot of heat in South Carolina. He told me, I talked to him yesterday, that he was even getting beat up pretty bad, were his words.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's a tent city formed outside the governor's mansion at the moment.
Really? Yeah, that's uncomfortable. Obviously it was his decision not to take the funds in the first place that triggered the whole series of events. Here, who was behind that? Is this guy just a diehard conservative and his ideology would be, no spending? He doesn't believe in the Keynesian approach at all. And how is the polling in South Carolina? That's my second question. How are people who are actually on the ground and suffering taking to that particular strategy?
Well, it seems unpopular in South Carolina. I haven't seen any polling per se, even the Republicans in the state legislature are fighting him on it, which is not a good sign. And they're in fact trying to go around him and apply directly for stimulus. He's not running for anything though, except for president. He's not seeking re-election next year.
So he is running. I mean, he has been actively cultivating the exploration committee, listening tour type.
Well, so even it's early for that. I mean, he's kind of positioning himself on the national stage.
Ask Sarah Palin about that.
He is also extremely conservative. This isn't some kind of like recently adopted thing. And the case he makes, to be fair to him, is that basically there are all these spending programs in South Carolina that are out of control that he's been trying to reform. And it to just sort of pour more money into them will kind of bolster this system that's in very bad shape and that he wants to change, particularly in education. Although the idea that the South Carolina schools, which are just disastrous, one of the worst systems in the country, don't need more money has also been kind of, people in South Carolina don't think really buy that.
How are the papers taking it there? How are the editorial boards, the intelligentsia receiving the governor's noble gesture of refusing stimulus funds?
It is grandstanding. And even the conservative, the editorial boards that might sometimes back him or have been lambasting him.
So he's out on that, he's a little bit of that polar bear on that iceberg right now is what's going on.
I mean, in South Carolina, this is not good for him, but he's also become, this sort of like figure of the national conservative movement, of the real opposition to Obama. Other governors, Palin, Jindal, a couple others who sort of suggested that they were going to not accept stimulus funds basically backed down, when push came to shove and the money arrived. I mean, Jindal, I think, is refusing something like $9 million, and Sanford is refusing $700 million. So, like Rush Limbaugh the other day said, mm-hmm. He was one of his favorite national figures. I don't think Mark Sanford really was.
That's really not the endorsement you want right now.
In the Republican presidential primary, it sure is.
Really?
Oh yeah, of course. Because you're trying to appeal to Republicans.
Yeah, I guess in a primary, but that's repeating the same old, seemingly the same old cycle. So is he cherry picking among the stimulus dollars he's choosing? Is like smorgasbord? We'll take this because we won't be on the hook for this and that. And how does that work out?
He is cherry picking. It's a $700 million state fiscal stabilization fund. Which really would basically just go to fund a real wide range of state government programs. There's some other healthcare funding, for instance, that he is taking, which is the stuff that Jindal's refusing. But this is a pretty broad swathe of money. I mean, it's a whole lot of programs that people are complaining are going to get cut because he's turning this down.
So how do, I mean, is it, has there been any discussion, and my guess is Ben Smith at Politico, any discussion of recourse on the part of citizens groups who feel that it's almost there's like an equal protection of the law issue? They're getting gypped by means of the rest of the country?
A lot of activist groups are really up in arms about it. As I said, some of them are living in a tent city outside the governor's mansion. State legislators have also been looking at ways to get around it legally, and although the Attorney General has rendered an opinion that they basically can't, but I think one of the candidates for governor is suing him. I think it was announced today or yesterday that he's going to sue Sanford to try to force him to accept the money.
Who is that?
The guy's name does not spring to mind.
It's just somebody.
See how great this is for the politicians of South Carolina. We've got to learn all their names now.
Well, I just had on Greg Harper, the new congressman from Mississippi's 3rd, and you know Eric Cantor. All these guys who are in the sort of opposition are standing up, making names for themselves in doing so, obviously. But the question is it going to backfire? So here's my question about him, Mark Sanford. What's his background? Where is he coming from? How did he get to be governor?
Gosh, I can't. You know what? I do not have his bio.
His bio, again. Okay. Because is he a legislator or is he like a?
I'm pretty sure he's a businessman. He came out of the private sector into the governor's mansion, but I can't give you the chapter and verse of his career.
And I'm wondering what his houses are, his legislature. Is it all three in the Republican hands?
The Senate, which is the relevant one here, is under Republican control, and the sort of main figure is the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, who announced what he called a chaos budget. You know, basically, like if Mark Sanford gets his way, we're going to close all the schools, fire all the doctors, like a real sort of worst case scenario budget in response to Sanford that really, I think, freaks people out quite a bit. Had the desired effect of rallying a lot of opposition, and he's a Republican.
Okay, so this is a real high wire kind of balancing act for him. It got him some national notoriety, but it could get him the wrong title of you. That
get
was
him,
like.
Yeah. It's getting him a lot of local heat, for sure.
Yeah, it could be a cherry bomb,
in other words. It's also going to make it that much harder to, run the state on a day-to-day basis.
Because they're broke and they don't have any money, and South Carolina's
exactly,
not
yeah.
doing so well as it is. Okay, so now is he at the top? Last question here, Ben Smith. Is he kind of, we're always looking for, as we dip into the other side, who's emerging? You know, Eric Cantor kind of had his heyday and then went on MSNBC and it seems like, whoa, he got hit. He got shot down. Sarah Palin and now Levi Johnson, all this stuff has just turned that into Jerry Springer'sville. So is Mark Sanford the new one? Is he the newest aspiring? Maybe he has a chance to have some gravitas and assume leadership?
Yeah, I think that's probably what's going on here for sure. Although, it's a long time and I mean, I think the consequences of his actions for South Carolina are going to matter. I mean, he's currently trying to negotiate with the legislature to get some sort of deal where they would make some cuts in exchange for his taking the money, which may be the likeliest scenario.
Bargaining power.
Right, and, I think, if he can come out in a couple of years and say, look, I passed this program of merit pay for teachers with this threat, for instance, or something like that, maybe that'll look good. But if kids' test scores go down, class sizes get bigger and stuff like that, I think that's going to be a pretty hard sell.
Yeah, those results, they're a bitch.
And that's the nice thing about, we're 4 years out, so the results, for Obama most of all, but for everybody, are going to, kind of determine things.
Right. Great. Well, Ben Smith, we appreciate you getting us filled up here on the Mark Sanford situation and the ads, controversial ads. Politico is where you can find Ben Smith's blog, and we like it. I check it out every day, Ben.
Thanks for having me on.
You bet. You have a great day. All right. 1-888-64-NANCY. Mark Sanford fighting back. It's an interesting ad. I watched it earlier, and his demeanor is different. Definitely better than Bobby Jindal. I'll tell you that. He didn't have that folksy thing going on. He's kind of a cross between Mike Huckabee and who else? I'll think about that, and I'll tell you on the other side. 1-888-64-NANCY, and we'll get your calls in as well.
I'm
One day closer to Friday. The Nancy Skinner Show. At least I know what day of week it is. That's always a good thing. I'm Nancy Skinner. 1-888-64 Nancy or 1-888-Nancy. I get them all. and I'm okay with that. I'm comfortable in my ness. So we just got off the phone with Ben Smith. We're talking about Mark Sanford. I guess this is a Republican half hour. And I talked to, I'm still happy about my interview with Greg Harper. Nice guy, new congressman from Mississippi, who voted against the stimulus bill because we have to pay for it and it's needless spending. Yet when I questioned him on the cancellation of the F-22 in his district, plane that cost $350 million a piece and is obsolete, according to military experts, he said, well, we need the jobs. So then I had to go in for the kill and say, isn't that stimulus spending? Isn't that economic useless spending for jobs you just voted against? Oh, it was beautiful. All right, 1-888-64-Nancy. Chris is in New York City. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Nancy. First, I have to say I just started listening to your show, and I love it so far. Before, I have listened to Rush and, you know, all those guys. One thing I wanted to ask is how does spending more stimulate the economy? I've listened to, you know, Limbo and his argument on how cutting taxes stimulate the economy and make jobs. I wanted to know exactly how it works that spending more money stimulates the economy.
Right. That's a good question. I am so happy, Chris, that you are listening to me after listening to my honey bunny, Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah.
All right. So here's the deal. So, there are two theories that you can either directly spend in a situation like this where we have a downward deflationary spiral. The private spending isn't happening. There's not enough demand out there. There's plenty of goods. So why he's wrong, first, is that cutting taxes to encourage businesses to make more stuff isn't going to work. They've got inventories. We're like 6 months of inventories with cars. Nobody can afford the stuff. And so businesses don't need incentive to go make more stuff that they can't sell. Retail sales today, another terrible number for them. They can't sell stuff. So what happens when you have, it's called Keynesian economic policy, but fiscal stimulus is, the government, when we get stuck in this situation, the government is the only entity that has enough leverage, enough money to start with projects like infrastructure projects, what they call shovel ready, the smart grid, to keep the spending. It's called an economic effect, a multiplier effect. So, for instance, if you get a little bit more money in your state, Mark Sanford's refusing it, those people, they're not going to lose their jobs. They will continue to spend income at their retail establishments. It's something like 7 times over in your local community. If they lose their job, because they don't get that, then they're going to cut back on their spending and everyone else goes bankrupt. This is when the reason we do this, and we can do it in a recession a little bit to do it, but it is really the only option in this situation, Chris, in a depressionary and deflationary environment. It's the only option because I'll tell you why. You have two tools in the economy. You have monetary policy and fiscal. Monetary, that's where the Fed lowers interest rates to encourage growth. But there's not enough demand, so they went down to zero. We don't have that weapon in our arsenal anymore. It's gone. The only way we are going to get out of this is to spend money to keep people employed, build our bridges, build the smart grid, invest in healthcare, all these jobs, so those people spend money, buy cars, and we all start that upward cycle again, and then we have to cut the spending on the other end. Once we get through it, once we survive the crisis, then we will get out of it and take prudent steps to get back in shape, back in good health. But this is an emergency. This is an illness. This is a virus. This is an antibiotic. I think I've answered your question, Chris. Hopefully. If not, call back. We're moving on. We're getting up the update on the countdown in Motown. Coming up. Tick, tick, tick on the Nancy Skinner Show.
But that ain't gonna help me now. Trouble.
person who knows anything about the auto industry, you don't have to believe me about what a bankruptcy might do. We're going to get into that a little bit. It is the Nancy Skinner Show. I'm Nancy Skinner, 1-888-64-NANCY. After yesterday, quite a show, yesterday where we are continuing our effort. We learned from the Wall Street Journal. If you didn't listen to the show, why not? But we had Jane Hampshire from Fire Dog Lake on reporting on the Wall Street Journal article that four banks who are bondholders of Chrysler, chief among them, Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase, is holding out to push Chrysler into liquidation where they think they'll get a better deal. They have secured debt, and so they think they'll get a better deal with a dissembled company. And so we all got on the phone and said, okay, then we feel we're going to do better if we take our money out of Chase, so that this ripple effect throughout the entire automotive, not just automotive industry, supplier industry, but the entire economy, is not being held hostage by a couple of banks that got taxed, big time taxpayer bailout. So that was the big thing yesterday. A lot of people have been writing me about that. I will be speaking, this Saturday at 2 o'clock downtown in Detroit, Jane Hampshire with Marcy Wheeler. Jane Hampshire will be in Washington D.C. I'm going to continue to update you on that. But I saw this story caught my eye. I really want to get to the Bristol Palin, Levi Johnson story. But come on, folks, listen to this. This is a commentary on CNN. Don't let General Motors go bankrupt. And it was written by Jack Nared. He's the executive editorial director for Kelley Blue Book, you know, where you figure out the value of your cars, and co-host of America on the Road, which is a big road car guy show. He's editor of Motor Trend magazine and The Complete Idiot's Guide to Hybrid and Alternative Fuel Vehicles. All right, so here's what's interesting about what he said, because I've been one of these people that he's talking about on his side of the aisle, though. He said everybody is saying that we have to do a quick cleanse and go into bankruptcy. He said over the past few weeks, pundits of all stripes have appeared on financial news networks suggesting that entering Chapter 11 is GM's only way to future vitality. Get on with it, they say, and save us the agony. It's almost universal. Except, Jack, you haven't seen me on any of these shows, Cashin' In or Bulls and Bears or Fox Business Network, where I've been the only one, the only sane voice saying, and I've said this specifically, we're going to put these link to the my website, NancySkinnerLive.com, because I did all those videos. You can see all my TV work from the last couple of weeks talking about this on CNN and Fox and all these shows. But that's what they're saying, is that pre-pack is the only way to go, and they act as if they know what they're talking about. Now, this guy knows the business, right? He says that it's the only way GM, they say that it's the only way they can get relief from their immediate cash flow issues is to substantially modify their union contracts. That's the only way they can get rid of their union contracts, dump unnecessary brands, close their plants, and right-size their operations. But, he goes on to say, what will that do to a company who has to sell cars? They did a study at Kelley Blue Book. They asked 500 potential new vehicle buyers a string of related questions about this question, this multi-billion dollar question, that is. He says that the responses are very telling. Asked, how likely would you be to buy a car from General Motors if they went into bankruptcy? 42.1% of new vehicle buyers said they were not at all likely or not very likely to do so, 42%. Even with a warranty guarantee from the federal government, as President Obama and the Auto Task Force is kind of holding that out there, consumers are not enthusiastic about considering a car, a GM car. Such a guarantee only moves the needle about 3 percentage points, okay? 3 points. So that's not, you know, for all these guys saying, oh, you'll have a warranty, that's fine. I was on one of the shows this week. It's just like airplanes where people flew and they were in bankruptcy. That's a $200 one-ticket deal where you don't think that plane is going to be grounded. This is a 10-year commitment to a vehicle. And, you know, I've seen lots and lots of studies about this, but he also says there are other reasons to question the wisdom of Chapter 11 filings, the quick cleanse filings. beyond just consumer demand, there's a domino effect on the supplier community that many of the vendors for years have been on razor-thin margins and heavily dependent on GM for cash flow. If that cash flow ceases, even for a little bit of time, it'll send many of those suppliers into bankruptcy and force others to simply close their doors. So the likely, he says, likely bankruptcies of supplier companies would have a ripple effect throughout the entire American industry, causing hardship for healthier companies as well. Finally, he says, a quick cleanse bankruptcy. It's just very difficult to imagine that one of the largest industrial companies in the world would not take them more than a year or more to unravel all this. And if they're languishing in for a year or more, it's over. Game over. Okay? This is a guy who, Kelly Blue Book, valuing car, listening to cars, listening to consumers, saying, these guys are all wrong about it. These guys are completely wrong about this idea that we can go into some pre-pack. And these guys, you know, I mean, I debate them all the time on these financial shows. They like to say, oh, it's just the same as any other industry, a pre-pack thing will come out. No, this is a whole different deal. Joining me to talk about it is Brian Fredline. I'm sorry, he is the president of UAW Local 602 in Lansing. Their plant is Delta Township Assembly's GM's newest plant. They build crossover vehicles. Thank you first, Brian, for being with us.
Thanks, Nancy. Glad to be here.
Mr. President. Okay. So you guys have been taking a lot of heat, the UAW, for not stepping up to the plate. I've again, been on a million shows, you know, trying to dispute all these stupid numbers that keep get thrown at you, like $72
Absolutely.
An hour. How much do you make, sir? Do you make, you probably make $720 an hour, right, sir?
Yeah, that was the last time I checked, you know. We were watching, you know, the news, my wife and I, and the newscaster comes on and says, GM employees make $71 an hour. And my wife jumps up, and she's screaming and shouting. She runs out the door. I said, where are you going? She said, I'm going to buy a new washer and dryer. I said, wait a minute, honey. No, that's Fox News we're talking about. No, I make $28 an hour.
Because what they, for people, we'll reiterate that. Where that number came from was they took all of the benefits for the retirees, health and pension benefits, added that number to the current workforce and said that's their hourly wage.
And they even added surviving spouse benefits. These guys have been dead for decades, and they even added those costs in, divided it by the number of hourly workers, and said, that's what you guys make. It's voodoo math. It stinks.
Right. So you're $28 an hour. The average transplant, if I'm correct, is something around $24 an hour, right?
Yeah. But get this, Nancy. When they're working, I've got people in my plant making $14 an hour right next to a guy that's making $28 an hour. And those are our two-tiered workers. You know, I know that the UAW has done nothing proactively, depending on who you're listening to help General Motors, except we've negotiated a two-tiered wage, we've given up the jobs bank, we've given up our cost of living increases, we have provided the VEBA account, which removes $70 billion over time.
Explain that for folks that don't get that because they don't live here. A lot of people just hear VEBA. They don't know what that concession means.
I'd be happy to. When a retiree had a health care bill, he would submit it to General Motors. General Motors would then pay the bill to the insurance company. That way, all the legacy cost moved through General Motors' books, and General Motors would have to pay it. Now, by creating the VEBA, it's a voluntary employee benefit association. Now, well, as of January 1st, 2010, now when a retiree gets a health care bill, he will submit that bill not to the corporation, he or she, will submit that bill not to the corporation, but to the VEBA. And the VEBA will pay the bill, completely removing that billions of dollars of legacy cost off of General Motors' books. Now, if you don't think we've helped them enough, that's tens of billions of dollars shot in the arm.
How in the know are you, Brian, about what other participants in this this workout plan have done? It's my understanding that, and I understand that there are 15 members of the Obama Auto Task Force in Dearborn as
right.
we speak working on the plan, but that that you've had cooperation from other parties, that the bondholders are the real big holdout. But do you feel like...
Imagine that. The Wall Street guys are holding out for a better deal. Wow, that's a shocker.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? I don't know if you heard that. I went bananas yesterday about the Chrysler situation where, you know, they have a secured debt. And so J.P. Morgan Chase is preferring liquidation because they think they'll get more. And get this. This is what we're talking about. Firedog Lake is reporting that they may have credit default swaps, insurance,
exactly,
effectively, on their thing.
Through AIG, that's what the GM bondholders have. I mean, that's the newest transparency that I've heard about, you know, in the last couple of days, where you have a pile of GM bondholders, and maybe PIMCO included, I mean, the big boys, the hedge funds. And they're figuring if we drive GM into bankruptcy, well, we'll get 100 cents on the dollar because AIG will pay us off. Well, who gave AIG the money to pay them off? The taxpayers
did. We're giving the banks the money to bankrupt the auto industry and insure them.
This is a deadly circle.
Oh, all right. You know, yeah, and that's why I'm still on it, and I'm not going to let go of it, folks. I'm not. This is the cascading effect is just unreal, and so someone's got to do it. So we're going to continue to do that. I'm going to, Brian, when we come back, I do want to talk to you a little bit about comments. Fritz Henderson, others are saying, like, well, we think we can survive, but it's not conveying a whole lot of confidence to me about should they be pushed into this. The timeline is right on our doorstep. And we want to know what people can do, literally can do, who care about this and agree with us. So hang with me, buddy, will you?
I'll be there.
My president of the UAW Local 602, Brian Fredline, continue to. This is happening, folks. Need to know it. It's going to be huge. It's going to be worse to hear the news after. Better to hear it before, I guess, so you can do something about it. 1-888-64-NANCY. GM's got the same kind of situation going on, as we talked about with Chrysler yesterday. And this guy from Kelley Blue Book says it, too. Don't let him go. Don't be fooled by these hot shots on these CNBC. You're like Kramer? You're like Kramer and these guys? Tell you what they think should be done? These guys, the masters of the universe that tank the economy, that's the wisdom, that's conventional wisdom about they can survive a bankruptcy? Are you kidding me? We need John Stewart. We got to get John Stewart on this one. Coming up next. Turns out Michael Moore has joined the endorsement and endorses the boycott of Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase, as a result of their holding hostage Chrysler, trying to actually get more money out of them in liquidation and get a better deal with taxpayer dollars. So Michael Moore has joined onto that campaign. Go to my website, nancyskinnerlive.com, where we will keep you posted, as well as Fire Dog Lake is covering this issue. But it turns out that it's not just with Chrysler. GM as well, this idea, this really, and you know, jump in, 1-888-64-NANCY. Because if you have questions about it, I have the president of the a very powerful union here, UAW Local 602 in Lansing, Brian Fredline, and he can answer some of these questions. I know you have them about everyone's, oh, the union's got to go to the, you know, and I've heard these questions. So here's your chance. Have at it. Let's talk about what they've done, how they've contributed to this, the restructure, and what needs to be done. All right, Brian, so let's talk just a little bit about this. Fritz Henderson
right
now has made some comments that suggest that bankruptcy is imminent. In your view, are these really just to pressure the bondholders to do what's right, or are they really taking steps to go into bankruptcy court?
Well, I want to back up a little bit to last Monday. I mean, nobody seemed to have listened to Barack Obama, and nobody remembers what he said. And that's really frustrating for me. He said, First of all, it's not the worker's fault. Second of all, he said he's committed to a domestic auto manufacturing industry. And third, he said there's going to be some tough choices. He's not talking about Chapter 7, which is liquidation. He's not talking about Chapter 11, which is a long, protracted bankruptcy where the lawyers walk off with $400 million. What he's talking about is a short-term surgical bankruptcy. Now, if I'm a bondholder and I watched what he said GM's going to be viable. And we're going to make sure that we support a domestic auto manufacturing industry. So,
okay, would you translate that if you're a bondholder? I'm going to lose my investment. I better cut the best deal I can now because these guys are going to survive. He's going to drag us through this to take our haircuts. So we better do it now.
Yeah, well, and that's what I think Fritz Henderson is saying too. He's saying we can do this outside of bankruptcy. However, Wall Street has got to move off of this debt for equity swap. And why don't they want equity? If they feel that GM is going to be a viable corporation, that stock price is going to increase. Their holdings are going to increase. Everybody's going to make money. They want to make it on the front end through bankruptcy, not on the back end through supporting an American industrial sector.
Mm, yeah. Well, hey, we were out of time, but I do appreciate it. I'm not letting it go. Brian, hey, Fredline.
Have you back anytime. I talk to the bad guys, too. I talk to Fox, and, you know, I was on with Bill Hemmer the other day, so, yeah, I get
I'm
it.
Out there all the time fighting
Thank
a good
you,
fight.
Nancy.
You bet, sir. All right, thanks so much, Mr. President. All right, 1-888-64-NANCY. That is the number to the program. I don't know. I got a couple things I want to talk about. Bye. The Dow was up today. So everyone's going to be cheering because the Dow was up today. It's so funny that everybody looks at the scoreboard, not the game. But it was up some, closing over 8,000 today, up some 200 points. So there's some good news, right? And I had a whole host of stories yesterday wasn't able to get to about economic news. On the Nancy Skinner Show, and that's 1-888-64-NANCY or 1-0-NANCY. It was interesting to me. I'm trying to find my numbers, but essentially consumer confidence was up in this poll, that consumers were starting to feel hopeful or positive in a way. It's quite a jump from last before the election. Sort of funny. There were three studies, and one was that consumers were feeling more optimistic about the future in general, that the number of people who said the country was on the wrong track had changed drastically, and that they were feeling that the future would be better. There was a survey of CEOs, the Business Roundtable, that was in the other direction, feeling that things were getting worse. And I had to laugh at that. I'm like, the CEOs, it's finally reaching them, that are these CEOs that were polled in this round table because their personal their situation is, hey, I'm going to be cut back from a $20 million bonus this year. Probably only going to make about, I don't know, $14 million. So the CEOs, the Business Roundtable, they're a little bummed out. I can't find the report that I had. But in general, there was some good news about consumers are feeling better. Now, here's the thing. Now, today's report came out about retail sales. This is, let's see, these were the February figures, or March figures, I'm sorry, that were worse than February figures, that the rate of economic deceleration that plagued stores during the holidays has slowed just a bit, but still, retailing fell another 1.8%, according to Thomson Reuters, this group that polls retail sales. They said it's not every retailer is in free fall, which it was during the holidays, but still a long way from 6 months, they say, plus from settling into recovery for retail sales. The only one, like Abercrombie & Fitch, you can imagine, these high-end stores not doing well. The only retailer that was up, do I need to tell you this? Can you not guess this? The nation's largest retailer, Walmart, was up 1.4%, excluding fuel, that is. But even Walmart, you know, still, that's not a whole lot. We got Easter coming up. People are hoping that that's going to spur some spending. And what they're saying is that people are choosing to spend money in key discretionary categories across the store, different stores. So you're getting some improvement in things like home buying, like you really need a washer and dryer. So what I'm thinking, what I want to put out there is, this is something I've been thinking about asking, so why not? Because I do want to ask this. These are just statistics, right? These are people on telemarketing companies calling you and asking you these questions. So I'm going to ask you this question at 1-888-64-NANCY. What are you cutting back on? I mean, obviously we know consumer spending is going down. And we've talked about, lots of people have been at the other end of the bad financial situation. We talked about that with credit cards yesterday. So everyone's feeling a pinch, I think, except for really. I mean, maybe if you're high income, I'd like to hear from you too. Maybe if you have high net worth, are you cutting back? And how are you cutting back specifically? Because I see these aggregate numbers and I talk in aggregate stuff, but we have real people here and real stories. So, you know, I want to know, there's two questions really I want to know. What changes have you made, really? What substantial changes have you made in where you shop? Let's say, if you never went to a Walmart before, are you going to a Walmart now? Because you have to. That's an interesting question to me, very interesting to me, because you're just feeling pinched. And then fess up. I know there's got to be some people out there that are doing that. And in what other areas? I'll tell you personally, I certainly have, I'm working hard just like everyone else, as I explained earlier in the show, trying to get a show off the ground, just endless hours and trying to cut back where I can. I know that... I've always been very vigilant about the electricity usage that I use because of my viewpoint of global warming, always turning down my thermostat to an exceptionally cold. What do you turn your thermostat down to? There's another question. John, you live with the folks, don't you? So I don't know what you turn your thermostat down to. I've been turning it down really low. I always have, like, to be mindful of it, but now
I
turn
it. You live with the folks.
You don't? Oh, I thought you did.
No.
Oh, sorry. My bad. What do you turn your thermostat down to?
It's currently at 69.
Right now while you're here at work?
Yes, because I live in an older place where if I turn it down much more than that, I'll have water pipe problems.
Oh, well, that's okay. That's an exception. I'm turning my thermostat down to, like, when I go to bed, literally it's low, like 60. And I just double up with comforters. I've always kept it low, but to me, it's like, you know, really don't need to do that. The other thing is, I must say, dining out, used to do it a whole lot more, go out and have a nice dinner. I'm not doing that so much, but yeah, it's because I'm working a lot doing TV. So there, you know, that might be that. I do like to get out and just, have a nice dinner once in a while. What else am I doing? Clothes. I'm not a big shopper. I'm not one of these shopaholics that could just say, hey, I'm going to go to the mall and check out stuff. For me, it's always, you know what, I need another suit. I'm on TV. I need this. I go in. I go out. Haven't really changed my shopping in that area too much. I'm, you know, pretty standard Macy's kind of person. I'm not the Sarah Palin $150,000 Saks wardrobe, although I aspire to be someday. So, I mean, I've made changes. We've all made some changes here and there. And the other question is, in doing so, is there any good? I'm always trying to find the good in some things. Is there any good that you've discovered? Little things that you've done that you've discovered? I'm going to give you a really simple example. You know, I don't eat a whole lot of bread. I'm not a big carb person, but you know, I just make sure that I don't waste things now. This is weird. Are we getting depression-like mentality? We didn't live through, I didn't live through the depression. I know my parents did, and people can tell you endless stories about how there's a whole different mentality that existed with that generation and our generation. I heard somebody, this is what sparked my whole thought on this the other day, a woman saying, she used to not even think twice about that $3 ATM charge when you go to a foreign ATM. And you have to pay that charge. But now she'll go out of her way to get to it and avoid a $3 charge or $2 or whatever it is. That makes a lot of sense to me. I'm mindful of not wasting stuff, food. So what's great, well, here's a good story. So I bought a loaf of bread, and I don't eat bread very much. It's been sitting in my fridge forever, and I, you know, just like I clean it out. I threw it out to the squirrels, and it's lovely. My yard, the squirrels, to see them come up to that piece of bread, it's like heaven. And I'll just sit out there and watch them discover a whole piece of bread. And I think, you know what, this is pretty cool. That squirrel, and I know this is weird, but that squirrel, I just made that squirrel's day. And just see them, the look in their eyes. And we've had some flooding going on recently here with the snow. So I don't normally have a pond in my backyard, but I do now. And a couple of ducks showed up. So I'm feeding the ducks and the squirrels with my spare food because I feel like waste is bad right now. I do, and I'm trying to do my part in wasting. Even though I know we should be doing our part in spending as well, I'm mindful of that as well. But I'm like everybody else. You know, buy what you need to buy, but be prudent about it. So the question is, I want to ask other things, other changes you've made in your lifestyle, and if they're good and positive changes or... No, not so much. Let's start with Karen. Hi, Karen. Welcome to the show. I'm sorry, Patty. Patty, I'm calling you Karen. Hi, Patty.
Hey, hi. How are you?
Great, thanks.
Yeah, so one of the big things I've done is in the area of food. My husband and I go out maybe once a month now to a restaurant, but we are real careful with our marketing. We go for coupons. We have a 99-cent store out here in California, and they've started selling a lot of food, so we buy food there. And,
you know what? That is amazing. I went to my first dollar store last week because it was next to the Office Depot, and I saw they had some gift wrapping stuff that I needed. I went in there. Those dollar stores, they have everything in there. I couldn't believe the stuff. They had food. They had tools. So I'm walking through this place going, who knew? I thought it was just, you know, I didn't actually tell you the truth. I didn't know what was in there, but I walked through this thing. They had, you know what I got? I got an S video cord, which is a pretty expensive, cable cord for my equipment. Normally, I think you go to a Radio Shack or something and it's $20. I got it for like $2.99.
Yeah, it's amazing. They sell, in my neighborhood, bags of potatoes. They sell organic and dairy. And I mean, honestly, they have everything, but, We're cutting down on luxuries. I mean, like I said, the last time I went to a movie, it's a fortune to go to a movie. So we just don't.
What is it? What is it right now? Because honestly, I've been so busy and working so much, I have not been to a movie. I can't even tell you.
$10, and that's a good price. At $10 a person.
Mm-hmm. And have you noticed? Are they filled up? Are there less people in the theaters? What's the turnout like?
Well, I haven't been. I haven't been in a while, but I do. I was at the mall recently because I had a bunch of coupons. That's the thing; they send you coupons, so you will go to the mall and you will look around. And there's people there. There's people out shopping, and there are people buying. But everybody's looking for a bargain. You have to have a bargain before you're going to part with your money.
Yeah, one of the areas that I had cut back for a couple of reasons was newspapers. Because I read a lot of newspapers, and I had always subscribed to the New York Times. And other paper, a whole bunch of them. And I always kind of felt guilty almost from a, but more from an environmental standpoint. Like I hate the idea that I read that and that tree is gone. I know that's silly, but, Eric Baldwin did a great post on Huffington Post yesterday about, you gotta read the New York Times, cause even, it's not the same experience to go online and get your news from TV or from the online thing, that you're just learning so much more. So that's an area that I agree with him. I got to go back and get my newspapers back and start supporting my newspapers, my local and New York Times papers. There's other areas I don't miss at all, eventually. But they're saying, what they're saying is that at some point, pent-up demand is going to force people to go spend. So that's the other question. Is there something you're just like, oh, this man, the price on this is, I gotta go. I gotta buy it now. Right now, look at these. I've never seen prices like this. Because that's what's going to start the whole upward spiral. So are you saying, that's just another question. Is there something, one item you're like, gotta bite the bullet, hon. Do this. Go buy it. The Nancy Skinner podcast? We need that coming to an internet near you. All right, 1-888-64 Nancy, that's the number of the show. All right, let's get personal here, shall we? Talk about retail sales and aggregate demand all the time. What about you? What about what are you like literally changing as a result of hearing all this news? What are you cutting back on, and is it for good or for worse? Some people say, you know what? It's not so bad. I'm okay. I've made some changes, and sorry. 1-888-64-NANCY is the number to the program. Let's go out to Los Angeles and get Jeff in here. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Hey, thanks for the show.
Thanks for letting me be on the air and work so that I can buy things.
So we can fight the good fight, right?
Right.
A few points. One, I'd like to point out that you'd probably be hard-pressed to find a newspaper that is not printed on 100% recycled paper.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
That's really good to hear. I didn't know that. Okay.
I think newspapers, traditional newspapers, need our support because traditional journalism is at risk. And also, you made some comment about, you know, let's not waste now. And my point is, you know, we need to kind of reset our thinking for long term and for the future. Let's not waste in the future either. And then we don't get into the mess that we're in. You know, I'm 43. Both of my parents grew up, and they were very young during the Great Depression. But it was always turn the light off if you're not in the room. You know, if you drive faster, you're wasting more gas.
But are you doing more of that now because of the recession? You might have heard that ad nauseum, Jeff.
I'll tell you, when gas prices were through the roof last summer, I noticed a lot of people in L.A. driving slower and more conservatively.
Maybe because they were depressed and
I like to think that they're actually conscious of what they're doing and they're trying to save money. I think a little bit of planning goes a long way as far as saving resources and saving money, like you're talking about the $3 ATM charge.
Right.
I mean, my brain goes to, okay, I'm at an ATM. Am I going to spend $3 worth of gas driving to my ATM?
Yeah, right.
So am I really saving money in the long run? But if you plan ahead and, hey, I'm here at my ATM.
You're thinking about it, though.
Now, but I'll take it now. And you know, planning trips, planning meals, you know, the whole deal. If you just plan and you think about it a little bit and just raising the consciousness, you know, I mean, we could.
Gotcha. I gotcha.
$10, we can all save 20% on what we're doing.
I agree, and I think it's here to stay, tell you the truth. Let's go to Z in California. Hi, Z.
Hi. I can't believe I'm on the radio.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just me.
Yeah, I cut back by saving money. I have 6 grandkids, and we like to get together and think of things we can do that doesn't cost any money. So we started skating, and we're roller skating, and we're walking and taking nature hikes, and we walk on the beach, and we found so many free things to do. But the upside is I've lost 30 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
I am so toned that the guys tell me, hey, I thought you were a kid. Get away from me.
Go, girl. See, that's a great example. Get out there and get some fresh air. Thanks, Z. Appreciate it. I think I need to do more of that. I'd like to walk to work, but it would take me an hour. Let's go to Beacon, New York. Beacon, New York, and speak to Lori. Hi, Lori.
Hi.
How are you?
Can you hear me?
I certainly can.
No, I was calling because I was laughing a little bit. It's like I've never, ever been a materialistic person. So I never, like, had to buy stuff, you know. And I have a good salary. I'm a social worker, and I, you know, and I'm feeling it now. Even though I've never been, you know, extravagant or anything, I can't afford, you know, I'm thinking I gotta, you know, stop buying lunch. I gotta make it, you know.
So that's one of the changes you're making? Because a social worker, I mean, obviously, yeah, you're going to be affected. So you're making your lunch? You're not going out to lunch?
Well, that's one of the things I'm doing.
You're probably healthier. That's probably better.
Probably, yeah. I've never driven a gas guzzler, you know, or anything like that. But I can honestly say that I can see that I have to start cutting back.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't even spend a lot of money, you know.
It's affecting all of us. Maybe we'll all stay at home instead of going out and cuddle up with a loved one on a couch and watch a movie or something like that. Maybe you can even talk and rekindle your relationship. How about that for a side benefit? Rush and I can kind of get to know each other again outside the heat of all this environment. We'll just talk about how we feel. All right. Hey, thanks for hanging out with me today. Let's go do it again tomorrow on Friday. It'll be a fun Friday on the Nancy Skinner Show.